You're listening to The Deceptionist, Truth Through Fiction. On this episode, Caroline, Kelly, Dave, and Jim talk about revision. That is where you go back over your work and cut out the stuff that doesn't need to be there. Probably like this right now. We should maybe cut this part out. That would be revision.
Darling, I should have reconsidered all those things I said I'd do. Now I'm changing all those changes that I made as I left you.
You are listening to The Deceptionist, Truth Through Fiction, a monthly, formerly fortnightly podcast all about the craft of storytelling. We're by storytellers for storytellers looking to bring a sense of community to that solidary pursuit of writing. My name is Kelly Stevenson, and joining me today we have the entire Deceptionist crew, including Dave Acampo.
Hey, everybody.
Caroline Pruitt.
Hello.
And Jim Rachowski.
Hi.
Sorry. I forgot to write hi in my script. See what happens? I need to revise my script.
Ooh, segue.
Nice. Yes, I'm so pleased with me. This week we are talking about revision, and we kind of wanted to kick it off just a little bit with talking about kind of what revision means sort of in a general sense, and then we'll get into some nitty-gritty stuff. We had a lot of great conversations, sort of pre-podcast conversations with people online, so we're looking forward to talking more about all the great things you guys said. So who wants to kick it off?
Well, I think just to set things up really quickly, I don't think we're going to define this too concretely and get into a debate over that, but what we're really talking about is you've got that story that you're working on, and maybe you write an entire draft and you're ready to start, polishing it up and making sure it's ready to send wherever you're going to send it, and we're talking about anything that happens within that process. But that process for some of us may come during that first draft, it may come after, it may involve other people. So we'll get into that as we talk about, what our processes are. So, I think just with that in mind, I think we should just talk about what revision means to us when we bring it to our projects. So, Caroline, what do you think? How's it work for you?
I feel like it's really dependent on the project. But it's also dependent on sort of some really concrete things that I deal with, like in habits and with workspaces. I had a printer and my computer was always hooked up to the printer. And I was really good about printing out a draft, making marks on it by hand, going back and making those revisions and saving things. And now I don't really do that. And that's something that would probably be beneficial, because what I tend to do now, even when I'm just rereading something, I have a really hard time letting it alone. So basically, most of my various drafts kind of just exist in some ether space where I have saved over them on the computer, basically. So I really have to be conscious if I want to save multiple drafts of something. As I'm reading over something, I will tend to think about, even if I feel like I have a pretty done draft, I know that before I'm going to put it in the position where I send it somewhere, I'm going to change some things as I go along. And just a lot of it is just sort of figuring out how the language sounds to me. So I tend to understand that what I'm writing the first time is going to change, and it's going to change at a bunch of points during the process. So that's sort of where I am. It's project dependent, but it's definitely something that's going to be ongoing.
Right.
The
technology makes it so easy to change anytime. Yes. Now, I think that's I'm thinking is you're talking about it's a certain amount of discipline to print it out and go over it by hand. And oftentimes, I think we'll talk about that probably a lot, is discipline is one of the biggest tools of revising, but the fact is technology makes it so damn easy.
Yes.
So do you find that now you revise sort of as you're going along, or just sort of willy-nilly, like jumping back and forth, like, oh, that line back there, that I didn't really like that before. Maybe I'll work on that now and then start going forward with my draft. Do you do that more often now?
Yeah, the draft that I'm working with right now is about 100 pages long. Okay. And so I've really gotten to use the Control F in the document because I might be working on something else. And I'm like, oh, I know that that got mentioned somewhere else. And suddenly I want to change another part of it that might be like 5 or 6 scenes earlier. So, yes, I think the answer to the question you asked was yes.
Yeah. Okay.
I think technology for all of this sort of revising and tweaking that it allows you to do so much more easily, it makes proofing harder. And for me, proofing is that sort of final step of revising something. And suddenly, you know, you've stared at the same screen 25 times and then you do kind of have to, at the end, find a printer and print it out and, mm-hmm. you know, stare at it in some sort of other medium for a while, or you'll just not notice things.
Do you ever, Kelly, do you ever read it aloud as to force yourself to stop and read every word?
Yeah, I do. Or at least if not all the way aloud, I will definitely move my lips while I'm reading it.
Yeah.
It kind of, for me, it depends on the project. If it's something small, like a short story, or I write a lot of blog posts at work, there's always that looming deadline that sort of helps kick me in gear. But for that kind of stuff, it's definitely, you know, post a draft or write a draft, edit it, kind of give it a once over, and then I'll walk away for pretty much as long as I can, even if it's just to like go get a coffee or whatever and come back, so that I get my eyes a little bit fresh, you know, and then basically kind of rinse repeat until I have to give it to someone. But if it's a larger thing, then I pretty much, as I go along, you know, you just kind of open it up and it's like, what do I feel like working on today? And sometimes going back over something you've written before to kind of get yourself in the right mindset, you see things right in there that you want to tweak and change. And so you end up doing more revising than new creation.
Yeah, I've known some people that do that. And I've done that on occasion where, let's say it's a short story, you know, and you're, I don't know, you've written 1,000 words that when, the next time you go back to it, you don't just start at word 1,001. You'll go back and start at the beginning and read through it, fixing things as you go along to kind of sort of like building up momentum. And then when you get to word 1,001, you're off and running and now it's new material,
you know,
which I think is a good way to sort of build that revision in. But, you know, I think, yeah, it's definitely, you know, all about the discipline of actually making sure you do that. And that can trip me up sometimes, you know. I will do that I've had to discipline myself a little bit because I will get really excited about something and I'll be waiting to write it till it's fully formed in my mind, and then I'll just power it out and then I won't go back and look at it again. And that's where I get just everything from the simple proofreading mistakes to, you know, language that isn't polished or that could be better. And, you know, I really have to make sure I go back and do it. But
I've had that same problem, and I find when I come back a day later that half of every thought has usually been left in my head, you know, like sentences trail off or things like, I didn't write that anywhere for anyone to know what I'm talking about. I just, because I know it, I powered right through. Yeah. I can't go back and look at anything without seeing huge mistakes, even if they're only in my imagination.
That is so important. I think, there needs to be some kind of space between the drafting and then looking back at it, because I know that I have had stuff that I wrote or I put up hastily and then would come back like not even a long time later, and I literally have no idea what these characters are talking about. Like, they are like alluding to something, but I either forgot to put it in the story, or it's a reference to something that I don't remember anymore. It's something I didn't finish, you know. So I think definitely, it's like your handwriting. Like, if you can't read your own handwriting, nobody else can. Right. And I very often can't read my own handwriting. So.
Which is another problem I have when I'm writing, because sometimes I will take a notebook somewhere and it'll turn into chicken scratch after the first or second page, because I'm so out of whatever, my hand will start cramping. Mm-hmm. And then if I don't immediately transcribe that within like 48 hours, the next time I look at it, none of it makes any sense.
Yeah.
Do you ever use that feature on your phone where you just talk to it and it turns the speech into text?
Siri does not work for that. I find that she works if you know exactly what you're going to say. But if you do any sort of plotting, she will kick off, and she's not a very nice girl. We're not friends right now.
No.
No.
Well, what you guys are talking, what Caroline, you were talking about in terms of the distance between it, that was one of the things that came up on Twitter. Magnet Girl, who's our friend Annika on Twitter, said that she thought it was important to put a little time and space between stopping writing and starting revising. And I kind of asked on Twitter, I said, well, do you have a specified amount of time or is it a gut feeling? And she said, yeah, you know, usually it's more of a gut feeling, but... the actual practice may be something like put this aside, do 12 other things, and then come back, and you know that's enough time usually. So, do any of you have a specific routine? I think Kelly, you said on shorter things you'll walk away from it and come back. Is that enough time on a shorter thing? And Caroline, when you said you know if you don't remember something, is that do you wait a while or do you have a specified amount of time or is it just a gut thing?
Usually it is. If I'm really into something when I'm working on it, I will say, okay, that's, you know, a basic draft. Usually my basic draft does not have an actual ending, but it has most of it. And it's like, okay, this is kind of what I want in the ending scene. Usually if I'm really into it, I will tell myself I'm going to stay away longer than I do. I will say, okay, I'm going to wait a week on that. And then it's, you know, something about it is hitting me 2 days later. And so then that feels right. The sort of, and I wonder if anybody else has this kind of the flip side is of it is when, if you let it wait long enough, the hardest part is like actually opening that document and looking at it and finding sure. what you yeah. did. Yeah. And yeah. so, so much time, so much time spent like that. But anyway.
And I think the danger too is not just not wanting to open it, but actually the distance being far enough that it's hard to access that mindset that you were in at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes that can be good. It gives you that clear view of it. But other mm-hmm. times I think you were writing it for a reason. You were in a certain, and it makes it hard to go back to that. You have to find mm-hmm. that rhythm again, or you have to find that voice or whatever it was. And you may not be there anymore. You may have already, yeah. especially if you were writing out of some kind of, you were trying to figure something out. You may have put that mystery aside, you know, in your own mind and gone on with mm-hmm. your day. And then you don't need to come back to that. And I think that is one danger of sort of letting things lie for too long. Although we've all heard stories of writers, authors who have, you know, put something away for 5 years and come back and said, now I'm ready to write this. I remember Neil Gaiman, I think it might have been the Graveyard Book, where he was saying he had that idea a long time ago, but he wasn't a good enough writer to tell that story. So that was a case where he had to put it away for a number of years and write other things and then eventually come back to it.
For me, the reason it's important to have some kind of an ending is because I don't find there's nothing more frustrating than I'm like, I knew where this story is going. I knew what this scene was going to be. It was very clear in my head. When I go back to look at it, it just stops and I have no idea.
So you need some kind of signpost in your draft.
I need something that's like, this is what, I need to have gotten it to a certain point or I'm just going to be like, okay, this is a great beginning that will never be anything because I missed that window when that was working in my head, you know, and it's not there.
Do you leave yourself notes?
No, I've gotten better about it and I try to do it. My problem also is I keep a lot of notebooks, or I used to, and then I lose them. So now I'm kind of just like everything's on the computer and it's all backed up a zillion right. times to what is Dropbox or
Dropbox,
something like that.
Right. Evernote is one I use where it syncs uh-huh. all my notes everywhere. So uh-huh. yeah.
but because I have a story that I think is, I'm like, I'm convinced this is a great story that is in note form in a notebook that I will find at some point. But it's just, I know that there was so much detail in it that I've completely lost because I'm not very good at keeping on.
Do any of us have a process where we don't actually do a full revision after we're done? Do we, like, where we actually revise as we go along and then that's it? You're done when you're done?
Okay, or? Something in my house smells like it is burning. I'm going to be back.
She forgot to leave a note for herself.
Right.
Right. Turn off the oven when you're done making cupcakes.
Right. I used to think that I didn't revise. at all. I used to genuinely believe that, and I came to realize.
Okay. Fortunately, I had put a pot of water to boil probably about 2 hours ago, and so the only thing that was making a burning sound was the burner and the bottom of the pot. But I'm going to go and put some water in it just in case. But I will be back. I just wanted you to not think that I had disappeared.
She's perished.
This is all going into the show.
Absolutely.
Not a word omitted. I came to realize that I was revising. I just revise every three sentences, essentially.
See, now that's what I was curious about. I thought you might be the guy that does that.
Yes, that is my bad habit. I've taken to – basically, every time I reread something, I end up changing it in some way, because I look back at some of the stuff I wrote 10 or 15 years ago, and I don't recognize that person, and I just, you know, I'd take a blowtorch to the whole thing if I could. But that's kind of my crossfire. Like Carolyn said, I have a hard time reopening those documents once I've closed them. And so I do go back obsessively and tweak as I go. So I guess, you know, that I'm going to count that.
Right. No, I think that is definitely revision, and I wanted to be clear that, you know, it's not always a full draft, but it's like the refining process you do as you go. So would you say that your typical day is like, if you're coming back to something, you'll go back over the paragraph you wrote previously or the page you wrote previously, and then you'll start moving forward?
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. I'm a big rereader. I do like now to kind of put something in a drawer for a day before I come back to it. I don't think I could do 12 other things and come back. I'd kind of have to let it lie for, you know, a sunset and sunrise.
But not too long, right?
No. The longer you wait, the harder it gets.
Right, right. Okay. Now, I'm curious, for me personally, I was really thinking about this because I really wanted to talk about revision. That was one of the things when we did our reflections and resolutions show. And I've really been thinking about this because it's something that I'm not sure I had clear definitions of in my mind. You know, kind of like you, Jim, when you said, I'm not sure I was revising, but now I realize I am.
Yeah.
And I realize that for me, there's a couple different things. There is what may come if you're writing like a longer piece and you're trying to figure out if the plot is actually working or not. And that's sort of like a big construction project in my mind. And that is something I realized that I do that early on. Where that goes into how I always talk about I collaborate a lot, or I talk to other people about what I'm writing. I feel like maybe I need to sort of have other people involved in the very earliest stages, maybe even before I put it to paper, you know, maybe when it's just rattling around in my brain, because I need to sort of break it, put it back together, make sure it works, so that when I'm actually doing my revision after I've completed a draft, that generally speaking is more of cleaning up the language. You know, if it's prose, it's always, wow, I use the adjective taut a lot, or whatever it is, you know? I use thick.
That's weirdly specific.
I know. No, I do. I notice little specific ones, like the word thick that I would use over and over again, or whatever it was, right? And then the other thing might be a dialogue polish, you know? And I noticed, especially if you're kind of taking that NaNoWriMo template, which is just power through that draft. It doesn't matter what you put there. I end up, if I'm doing that, if I'm sitting down because I've waited to write, I have it all swirling around in my head and I know I have to get it out, I can't pause to see if I made every description right or every bit of dialogue is as good as it can be. I need to just get it out and get to that stopping point. I think maybe something similar to Caroline, what you were talking about, like giving yourself those signposts. So maybe it's not totally done, but you know where it's going now. And but then my revision tends to be more just, you know, that surfacey stuff, you know. So how do you deal with revision where it's whole plot points that maybe didn't work? I know, Kelly, I know you've talked about like changing stories as you go. Do you consider that part of revision or?
We talked about the drawer that we put things in when we don't like them anymore, yeah. Or setting fire to things. That's what I do usually.
But you had a specific one you talked about in one of our shows. I think it was one of our recent, the New Year's one. And you were talking about something that you thought was going to be this, and now it was steampunk or something, and
yeah,
it was shifting.
Well, that was NaNoWriMo, so I had to keep going. If that hadn't been NaNoWriMo, what I would have done, and I should actually go back and do, is once I realized that it was steampunk and Victorian, I would have stopped and figured out, first of all, what that meant inside my head, other than it's steampunk Victorian, go. and try to rework sort of the beginning, maybe not completely do a full revision at that point, but definitely make notes in it as to this needs to change to this. This will obviously be different, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then powered through. And that one actually changed again. Suddenly it became this like whole like hospital. It was bizarre. It was almost like, it's like one of those silly books where it's like sliced into three pieces and like there's a bunch of heads and a bunch of shirts and a bunch of pants and you just like flip them and create crazy characters. Oh, yeah. It's kind of what it ended up being. Like bizarre choose your own adventure. But yeah, I think I was going somewhere interesting and I don't remember anymore. So someone else can take it.
Let's revise that.
Right. Well, I do think what you're talking about is revision, which could be changing whole plot points, changing, you know, or adding. And I was thinking of an example. Back when I was in grad school and I used to workshop a lot of stuff, I know I had written a piece that was, I think it was like a three scene story, and it might have been an assignment for a class to write something with three different scenes. So it's like one, it's a girl who's in high school, and like the first scene is something of her with her friends talking about like a problem with her boyfriend, and then the second one is her with her mom, and then the third scene is actually her with her boyfriend. So it's kind of the three different things that they do to work it out. And so then I kind of felt like that, like I needed more, because it was just a girl in high school and there really wasn't any context to what her life or her relationship was. So then I ended up writing this whole other thing where her boyfriend was in the Navy, and it was something of them going to his boot camp graduation, and so there were some scenes that happened with that. That was a flashback. So I basically ended up writing these two different timelines, and then, so I sliced up the original story and put those other scenes in it. And then I took that to the workshop and somebody was like, oh yeah. And so people liked it. And then somebody pointed out there was like a logical problem with like when the character knew something, because I had put the two stories together. It's like, well, she should know this all along. She shouldn't be finding this there. And I was like, oh yeah, that's right. And then I never revise it again. But I still submitted it for stuff, thinking someone might not, because most of the class did not notice that problem,
right,
until the one person pointed it out. But so I still kept sitting it around, but like I knew why it didn't work, and I was never able to fix the thing where it worked.
Right.
And then after a certain point, it kind of got, it, you know, it wasn't like the people and sort of the situation that I was writing about wasn't really something that was speaking to me anymore.
Right, you got too far away.
So it went into
it.
A drawer.
Well, it went
into,
well,
right.
it changed because it was a thing about him being in the military, and then we had a war. So like literally the stuff that I was writing when I lived in Norfolk, you know, in the 90s, I couldn't really write about in 2005, because literally, you know, unless I wanted to make it a historical piece, which
that,
I didn't.
That happened to Charlene Harris. She writes the Sookie Stackhouse vampire novels. She's got this huge series, and it all takes place in southern Louisiana, right?
And then Katrina.
And then Katrina hit, like, about halfway through book four or something. And she had one of the main characters had a huge, like, the power seat of the entire state was in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And then Katrina hit, and it was like, so do I write this in, or do I pretend like it doesn't exist? And she kind of ignored it for a book or two, and then finally addressed.
Like, you have to deal with it.
You can't just pretend, like, you can't speak to that. You can't write to that audience and then pretend like this major, you know, life altering event that happened in your audience's lives didn't happen in your books.
I can imagine that was probably really interesting. I mean, I haven't read those books, but anyway.
No, I think that it's fascinating, because that's one thing I didn't think we would talk about when we talked about revision, was how real life impacts can force you to revise. That's fascinating. I hadn't even considered that. But
you sometimes, like, I saw the movie Ides of March recently, which is about an election campaign, which is obviously based on a play that was written in 2008 about the 2004 election. Mm-hmm. And if you try to watch it now, it's just completely nonsensical because of where American politics are now as opposed to where they were then.
Right.
And so stuff. Yeah. So you, and that's something I think that's an extreme example, because that's something that's really time sensitive, and they didn't really try to do anything to acknowledge that. But yeah, I mean, the world does change and things come in different ways. So, I mean,
It depends on the type of writing you're doing and how based in reality you are or in the zeitgeist. You know, I mean, that does make an impact for sure.
You could be writing a script for a long-running television series and have one of the main actors die. That happened on The West Wing in season 7.
Right. Yeah,
they were doing that presidential campaign, and the actor who was running, I cannot remember his name for the life of me, but he was the vice presidential nominee. John Spencer, probably. Uh-huh. Let's pretend that's what it is.
That guy.
He died as they were filming the election outcome episode. And as a result, like, they were going to have they were actually going to have the Democrats lose, but when he died, they thought, well, we can't pile on defeat and death, and, you know, it was just too much. So it completely changed the trajectory of the season and the outcome of the fictional election, because one of the actors who was the linchpin of the ticket was gone.
Wow.
Well, and that happens. I mean, that happens actually fairly regularly with TV, if not deaths. Well, you had like John Ritter in, 10 Things You Have to Know to Date My Teenage Daughter, something
Let's
absurd.
Call it that.
We do not have an IMDb's mastery of the facts on this particular episode.
He was like the main sitcom character in the show, and so they ended up sort of writing around it, and then like David Spade showed up.
Yeah.
And then you have 2 1/2 Men, where Charlie Sheen just went apeshit. You know, you've got diva actresses
who decide they're not coming back.
You've got, let's go back to Coach from Cheers, and then
Mr. Hooper.
So there's a rich history of this.
the thing is, if you hold on to your precious script for too long, then things are going to change, either personally or externally, that your script, your story, whatever. I mean, you know, and that does make a difference. I mean, if you want to like have this certain locus in time, like if that story I had been writing had been, okay, this is what it was like when I was 16, I don't think I would have had to change it. I was writing something when I was, you know, 25 that was more or less present, that was about much younger characters.
Right.
And so that's kind of like, you know, well, and I'm like, okay, well, maybe I should have done something with that when I had a chance, or maybe it just wasn't, you know, it wasn't the thing. Maybe I went as far as I could with it. I kind of go back and forth on that.
Well, I want to go back to what you were saying, because what was interesting to me when you started talking about that story is you said you had something, a draft written out in this three-act structure, and then something wasn't working, so your revision was actually going in and adding this sort of other story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you sort of sliced it in. I say adding is because Dave Carr on our Twitter conversations was referring to the scene in Sandlot where the dad, he said, that scene in Sandlot where the dad, the stepdad is teaching his kid to write, good, now make it half as short. And so that was interesting, because then I think we both immediately chimed in talking about, you know, addition and subtraction and revision. You know, do you guys find yourselves adding things when you go back to revise? Like, here's either a character bit that it could be anything from a way to describe something to an actual subplot. And then how much is cutting out the bad writing, or like maybe the scene needs to end sooner, or maybe I'm going on too much. If you say less, this is more powerful. Do you guys have an experience with that in terms of revision?
I'll occasionally have to add something because I forgot that the audience doesn't know it. You know, like we talked about earlier, I get so full of my own steam that I just blow through the draft and neglect to fill in vital information because I know it. And I forget that nobody else knows it until I write it down. But by and large, if I'm doing any revision, I'm looking at it and saying this could be more. This could be expressed more concisely. You know, I'm always hacking, making three words into one, if at all possible.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I've been doing a lot more longer form writing at work, and the feedback that I quite often get is, that's great. Can you make it shorter?
any sort of marketing or copywriting job you'll realize that a lot. I notice that's curbed my writing quite a bit.
Exactly. It's like, I've got all these words. And it's like, yeah, banner ad. We need like 7 words.
Exactly.
Like, and there's 5. Can't you just squish them in there?
Working on the script to my comic also had that same thing. Because when you realize that you have to put bubbles over the artwork that you're covering up, you realize, can we, and there was a lot of revision there in terms of going back and going, can we get the same sentiment across with saying less? How much of this is us like trying to be clever in our dialogue versus getting through the meaning with the dialogue? And so that's somewhere where I really found myself revising a lot at a later stage in the production of this. You know, particularly comics, but you know, yeah, that also happens in the marketing stuff.
Well, and so having done that for work, I've started, because I gave up video games for Lent, I've started doing more blogging in personal stuff, and I've sort of taken that that advice, and after I write a draft of a blog post, going back and being like, okay, how much of this does my audience care about? Like, I can take you through step by step and describe every single thing I saw in this house, and that's important to me, sort of, but the person who's reading this doesn't care about the kitchen if the point is there's a ghost in the attic, you know? They just need 2 sentences of the first 2 floors were fine, and then we got to the attic.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and that's clearly about revision. That's totally about realizing that, you know, you know, using the extended sequences where it's important, where the heart of the story is. So I totally get that.
This is really something with prose, and I've written much more prose than anything else. Like, I've played with some scripts for both screenplays and for comics, but I haven't done an extensive amount with it. And you really become aware, like, if you even just look at people's scripts, how little is said in dialogue, you know, with some exceptions. Like, if you read a Bendis script, that might be a different experience. But for most of the time they're trying to really condense scenes and really get, especially like TV, because TV is something that is, you know, you have a set amount of time to work with. Every once in a while, you get a show that breaks form and will have a really long scene. But most of the time, you expect scenes to be about the same length. You know, certain small exchanges of dialogue. Comics, again, most of the time you're working with a panel, with a certain number of panels. And like you said, even just the fact that you don't want to have like 10 panels in a row of the same people talking to each other, you will condense that down and really do the really essential words. So, and I think if a lot of what I consume is TV and comics, honestly, then, and I'm writing prose, I don't have those formal inhibitions. So I really, like, I have no sense of how long a scene ought to be. So then I'm really sort of, so my tendency is to write long because I have all the space to work with, and then try to go back and make it tighter. And I think most of the time that's a good idea. I think that there are times when I get the feedback, there needs to be more of this. I need to understand, not necessarily in dialogue, because, like I said, I will go on a long time with that. But just, like, tell me more about this. I need to know more of this. I need to see more of this. Usually, the instinct to shrink comes from me. The instinct to add comes from something I've told by somebody else. Like, the story that I've mentioned before was, it was workshopped. It was, and when I took the 3-scene story to workshop, people would say, well, I was wondering why she did this. I was wondering, you know, I don't know anything about this boyfriend and why he's important to her. So writing the longer part of the story was in response to other people's questions. So I feel like I kind of do what I need to do. Then I want to shrink it down. And then I kind of hear from other people what they think the story needs to include, and that's when it gets longer. Right. I've heard this called the accordion effect. Like, basically, you draft long, you shorten it, and then you, like, if you picture an accordion, which, and you just sort of smoosh it together and then pull it apart
again.
Right.
Well,
and
that's,
I think.
Go ahead. Finish.
I was actually done.
Okay. Well, I was going to say that's a perfect segue to talk about workshopping or bringing it to other people. But before we do that, I want to mention that, as Kelly mentioned at the top of the show, that we got a lot of great comments on Twitter, and I'm not getting to all of them because some of them we've already covered. Paul Montgomery, our former co-host on this show and Fuzzy Typewriter guy, as you all know him, he was asking about how long should you wait before revising, and I think we kind of talked about that. I think for most of us, it was sort of a gut feeling that it's, you know, not too long, not too short, but you'll know it. Julia Mizell on Twitter had talked about, you know, having just the fear of going back to that open document. So we kind of covered that. But I wanted to get to one, which is M.I. Milliman on Twitter asked, what do you think a first draft should consist of? I tend to just put ideas down, then work on craft and voice in rewrites. It's slow. So that kind of, before we start talking about workshops, I just want to talk about that really quick. Do you guys have any feeling? I mean, I know that to that point, especially with scripts, I will be wait. I have a process where I kind of wait a long time before I actually sit down to write. And when I do, I want to keep the momentum going. And so I will just write whatever. And you know, Kelly, that sort of NaNoWriMo thing, I'll just leave it blank now if I can't think of how to describe something. Or I'll jump down a paragraph and keep going. Because I want to get, I think to Caroline's point, I want to get that map so that I know where I'm going with it and I get to what I had thought in my head, at least to the point I had thought in my head, because in my head I was forming sort of an arc. And so I will bypass language and voice and all that kind of stuff to do that. But then that's what a revision for me is perfect for, is to go back and if it's a screenplay, it might even be formatting issues. It might be, or comics. There are times where I wrote like a comics page without going panel one, panel two, panel three, but just going like, so-and-so says this, so-and-so says this, so-and-so pulls out a gun, you know, whatever it is. And then I'll figure out how it breaks into panels and figure out how that works. Or if it's prose, I'll go back and I'll be like, what is the dialogue they should be saying there? And I'll spend more time with, you know, the dialogue or the description. You know, does that kitchen need the extra description, or does the haunted attic need the extra description? I mean, I'll go do all of that in a revision. What do you guys think in terms of a first draft? Where do you fall with that?
Well, as someone who didn't believe he revised until that part is not built into my process at all. The whole idea of keeping the momentum and just write something, and if you have to go back and revise, you'll figure it out later, is completely alien to me. I'm trying to train myself to get better about it.
Yeah, I think there's kind of a gray area between it's this question, what makes a first draft? There's sort of that concepting of, I want to write a story that, you know, answers this question or solves this problem or puts these two characters in this situation, and I want to figure out where they go with it. And I feel like there's that high level concepting that you do. And a lot of times for me, when I'm still in that sort of sketching it out stage, little bits of stuff will start kind of bubbling up to the surface. And so I'm in the middle of outlining, but I'll have five lines of dialogue because they came up. And if I don't write them down now, I won't get them. And so I have to go back, obviously, and work those back in. And most of the time they make it and sometimes they don't. But I feel like it's too gray at that point for me to really say, like, this is an outline and this is the story.
Yeah, I think that's a great point about, I'll do the same thing. I'll be working on an outline, but I'll have like a scene or a visual or something in mind, and I'll want to capture that because you don't want to let that go away. And there are times where you'll realize as you start to write it out that that doesn't even fit anymore, or you have something better or just different, and you have to go away with it. But I think it's important to capture those moments when they come.
It's really kind of annoying because like you want to get the whole outline out, and it's like, no, we have to do this right now. And then the scenes inside your brain are like, no, we're actually just going to play this whole scene right now. You need to get it down or it's going to be gone. And it's frustrating.
I was actually just pulling up because the thing I have now that's about 100 pages, I was looking at like the outline that I wrote, but it's not, I mean, it's just a bunch of, you know, kind of loosely connected paragraphs. That's about 3,600 words long. And then it ends with, I don't know what happens next. And so that guy, it's up to about 100 pages now, and I still don't exactly know how it ends. So
that's a brave choice. Maybe you should leave it in.
It'll be like, if I was like an independent filmmaker, it would be like a meta. I don't right. know, or the Muppet movie. I tend to assume that if somebody's going to read something that long, although I have also written things where I really, but this is more like short, where I didn't really know how they ended, and I just kind of stopped at a place and like had people like, I think that was very effective. That I wrote one, and this is not exactly a revising issue because it was like basically I had to do a reading when I was in grad school. And I was basically not finished with what I wanted to read. So I was just pounding away basically up until the night, and then like my brother was coming to the reading, and I was like, okay, I'm just going to say that I'm skipping these parts because I don't have time to write them. So I would, and then I read what I had, and he's like, okay, you don't really need those. You don't need to say there's a blank here where a scene should go, because there was actually enough in what I had written that I did not need to add as much as I thought I did.
Mm.
So that's kind of revision, because what my revision decision was I thought that I needed more in this story than was actually here. So I'm choosing not to write this section of my outline that was probably unnecessary.
Right. Right.
But that was also just so I could run it and have something to read that night. And I was, and I liked that piece. I liked when I read it, but I was never really able to make it work as prose, because I think I had been writing it so much in my mind as something that was oral, and it was just kind of missing something on the page.
Mm.
So that's kind of a, you know, if you can look at that as a genre in itself.
Right. I think that brings up a good point about getting feedback from others, whether it's you know, a personal editor or a workshop or something. I mean, there's part of me is like, it's my work. I know it better than anyone else. I don't care what you have to say about it, because you don't know. But having that outside perspective of like, you don't really need this, or you completely, I have no idea who this person is or why she's doing anything. I think it is kind of essential if you want to write something that other people are going to read.
Absolutely.
Like you need, it's like a beta for a software program or something. It's like, you just need, you need some testers out there to sort of get a feel for it.
Yeah.
But that's not part of my process in any way, shape, or form.
It definitely is a part of my process. I mean, that's something, I mean, obviously, as I was saying earlier, I in some cases, I'm collaborative enough that I bring people in early on because they're part of the project or whatever, and I kind of use that in a similar fashion as other people might use a workshop or a beta reader. But that is something that I was talking about on Facebook when I posted up about this. A friend of mine who I used to be in a writing group with many, many years ago, a woman who's a very good poet and writer, Teresa Tulipano, she was talking about workshopping your pieces in an invaluable way. And I asked her, I said, well, when do you do that? Do you do it after the first draft? Do you wait a little bit? Like, how, and you know, what are your feelings on, because I think the tricky part with that is, I think you need to have your sort of trusted advisors, people mm-hmm. who you respect, who will tell you the truth, and who kind of will get what you're going for. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody's going to like it, but I think you can never please everybody, and that's, you know, trying to put your like worst enemy on it to see if you can sell them, I think is, you know, just sort of madness. You know, I think you'd never get anywhere. But what do you guys think in terms of like your reading, your workshoppers or your beta readers? I know Caroline, when I put this you know where I'm going with this, right?
Yes.
Yay!
When I put this on Twitter, our friend Sigrid Ellis, who's been on this very show, she said her process was to give the story to Carrie, make pooky eyes at her, and beg for help.
Yeah, well, I will, and I'm not actually going to take credit for this, but Sigrid did recently have a story that she had published in Strange Horizons, was shortlisted for the Tiptree Award, which is it's a science fiction award that's specifically dealing with the perception of gender in sci-fi, but it's a pretty nice award.
Wow.
And she did get a shortlist for that, which, you know, was like a citation. And I was not the only person, but I was one of the people who helped her with many, many drafts of that story. So I'd like to, you know, shout out to her because she's awesome. But that, you know, it was neat to be involved in that process of something that really, I think, ended up being really successful and published.
And so, as her reader, her beta reader, what do you think, how did you see that process going? Like, how do you think you helped with that?
Well, she, in that case of that particular story, by the time I saw it, it was very polished. I mean, I think what she showed me could have been submitted and probably could have been published. So, you know, I had very easy thing to work with at that point. But, and we can probably link to the story in the comments. I think it's still up on Strange Horizons. It's an epistolary story. It's like a mother is writing these letters to her. Basically, the daughter is out having like some kind of adventures, fighting. It's been a while, so I don't exactly remember. But I think she's fighting like evil fairies. and the mother, which, you know, sounds silly, but it's written in it, you know, in the sort of urban fantasy way that, you know, it's a very, it really touches on the real world and what's going on in the mother's life. And then by the way she talks to her daughter, and she keeps sending her these letters, and you get only the mother's side. You get the hint that she gets some responses. But basically, I thought it was a really effective story to start with. But then, because I think of the specific form of the letters, it was a process to go through to really talk to the other person and say, okay, what is this woman conveying in this letter? Like, what if I was the person who was hypothetically getting this letter, what would I learn about her? What would I want to know about her? And so that was something to really be able to talk through. I think that's sort of the first basic revision is like, is your story conveying the information that you want it to convey? And then, you know, from that, we also did a few passes just like, well, what about specific word choices? Like, does this sound like the language that this person you've created would use? Is there, and then I think there was some, I think the mother, I'm trying to remember, the mother who's writing the letters also has an elderly parent or an aunt or something that she's communicating with. So I think more about that, about her interaction with the other family member, I think was added in one draft and then was sort of taken back, was scaled back. And that accordion process, because it's sort of, right. Basically I was like, well, who is this aunt and what are they talking about? And the first response to that was something that was, you know, very lengthy in terms of the size of the whole story. And then the question is, how much of that do we need?
Right.
And then, so that got shrunk down. But I think that particular type of back and forth, not every story is going to have that. Not every story is going to require that. But I think because of the fact that it was very polished by the time I got it, and because of the specific form of the story, it was really helpful to have a lot of back and forth. And again, right. I know it wasn't just me. I know she was, she had other people reading the story for her too. And so I don't know if they were maybe giving her similar comments to me. It's certainly frustrating.
But what's interesting in that is, I hear three different kinds of revision going on.
Sure.
I hear you sort of serving as a reader, kind of giving her feedback on this is the voice, the themes, this is the message I get from reading your story, which I think is the broadest kind of sense. Mm-hmm. And that's when I was talking with my friend Teresa, she was saying, I like to have a few drafts before I bring it to anybody, because then at least I know I've gotten it into as much of a story that of what was in my head, at least I've given it a good solid shot of getting it on paper by myself. And now I've got to take it to other people, because I think that's kind of important in that broadest sense is the message I'm getting coming across. I think I was thinking about this in my own work in that it depends on what type of piece you're writing as well, which is, you know, if it's sort of a wilder, loosely formed piece, it's all about emotional truth and themes and things like that, and it's not necessarily a structural thing. But then in like maybe a script or something, you might be more focused on, you know, is the structure working? Does it all work? It depends on what those aims are. But I mean, I think that's sort of a broader thing, all the way down to you just talking about word choices, which is that sort of description polish, a dialogue polish, you know, is this really working, right down to the nitty gritty. And then the third thing I heard you kind of talk about was, well, here's a subplot, or, well, I'm going to call it that, but let's say, you know, here's a bit with a character that it made me want a little bit more. So she goes and she expands, and then you're like, but wait a minute, is that taking away from that overall thrust of the story? Now we contract it again. And so I think that's really interesting, because I think those are three distinctive ways that you can go in and revise, you know, on each of those levels. You know, the broadest one is just that, is my message coming across? Hopefully it is. If not, maybe you have to break that story up, or maybe you have to do your refining process to bring out, to make it clear. You know, I think Jim or somebody said something earlier about, you know, like, they don't know what I'm trying to say, or I forgot, I left something out. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows exactly what I'm trying to say. There's that. You want to make sure that emotional thrust or that theme or that message is all being conveyed the way you want it to.
Yeah, and I think that it's important, like, you know, if you ever see any kind of, you know, published feedback on something that is published and it's very good, and you will see people make comments that indicate that they didn't get it at all. And right. that's not the writer's fault. That's the audience's fault. So I think you have to accept, like, I'm very hard on the audience, but, you know, it's not always mm-hmm. the writer's fault.
Well,
but
that's the big thing.
You have to accept
thing.
That not everybody's going to get it, but I think you do want somebody to get it. And I think you want to find a reader who is like, this person maybe at least, you know, 70, 80% of the time is going to understand what I mean when I'm communicating to them.
We probably all had this where you've been in a writing workshop of some kind and there's the person that's super defensive and they're trying to explain to you, you know, they're basically saying like, well, you just didn't get it, you mm-hmm. know? And I think, yes, there are going to be points where you have to go forward. And this is what, when I was talking with my friend Teresa in this Facebook thread, I finally came up with a description that I said, I later said, oh, I'm going to steal that and use it because I like it. I said, it's a matter of confidence and confidence, which is, there's a point where you're going to have confidence in your own writing and say, look, you know, not everybody's going to get it. But this is what I wanted to tell. But you also have to have the humility to be able to have people take a crack at it and see if there's stuff that you can work on. And but in the end, you need to have those confidants, your beta readers, your friends, your workshoppers, the people that your trusted advisors that are the people that at least they get what you're going for and they're not going to steer you wrong. And those are the voices that you can listen to the most and trust in the most, you know, but in the end, I think it all comes back to, and I'm kind of leading us into how do you know when you're done, which is that sort of nothing ever fits perfectly. I think, well, some people may think so. I have a trouble thinking that a story actually ends up being this perfect, like IKEA assembled bookshelf mm-hmm. where, you know, all the pegs fit and yeah. there's no parts left over, but you have to have that confidence to say, okay, I know what I was trying to say. I've got enough feedback telling me that I'm saying it. I'm looking at it and I believe that I'm saying it. I'm now done.
George Lucas is still revising a movie that he put out 35 years ago.
Don't be that guy.
Don't be that
yeah.
guy.
There's unless a cautionary you, tale.
Unless you could get billions of people to buy
it. Say, unless it makes you $1 billion every right. time you do it, in right. which case I will help you be that guy.
There may be a method
for a nominal
to his madness.
Fee.
Yeah. But, done for who? Because I think sometimes you're writing something and really all you care about is that one reader. You know, it's not something that's going to have a bigger audience.
Yeah.
But then, you know, if the question is like, you know, when do you show this to somebody who's not your buddy? You know, somebody like with Sigrid, like when did she decide to send her story to Strange Horizons? Something like
right,
that.
Right.
Or when was it Popcorn that you sent yours to? Yeah.
Yeah.
So well, Dave, why don't you start? Because I think you've probably submitted something more recently than any of us.
Well, yeah. And that's a good case, actually, because that was uh-huh. one where I came to a point where I didn't know if it was better or different.
Uh-huh.
So I wrote it out and I worked on it. And I read the How Smitty Smokes a Cigarette on our show, and then I worked on it a little bit more, mostly just polishing things. But I think I got feedback, and it might have been from you, Caroline, or it might have been from Paul, one of my beta readers, let's say, and they were like, you know, I'm just not quite sure about the ending. And, you know, I'm not saying it's bad or good. It's just like, you know, there may be something that you need there. And so I thought about that, and I thought, can I do something more? And so I actually got into it enough that I wrote a slightly different final passage. And this isn't much. I mean, I'm talking about two paragraphs, you know, but it was significant enough to me. I wanted to make sure that this ended, you know, the right way. And I actually kind of fell in love a little bit with what I had wrote. I thought, oh, I found a new way to say this. And I like mm-hmm. it. That works. But then I showed it to people again. And you guys said, well, that's good too. I don't know if it's better or worse. And so I finally had to look at it and really think what I felt was the strongest ending, and I just picked the first ending. I sent it off, and when I got the message back from Popcorn Fiction, he said, killer ending, loved it. And I'm like, okay, I'm glad I did that. So, you know, it was a point where I didn't know if one was better or the other. I might have uh-huh. gotten the same response if I had sent that off, or it might not have worked. I don't know. But I just had to kind of have that confidence of looking at it and going, you know, I really like the ending that I came to. It's just, it felt so organic. It felt like right there. It was sleek. Maybe it doesn't explain everything, or maybe it needed another beat, but I just kind of liked it. And in the end, I'm going to stick with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, that was my experience with it.
I sort of require a deadline, even if it's arbitrarily self-imposed. Because otherwise I'll just noodle with it for the rest of my life. There's this Lorne Michaels has this quote about Saturday Night Live that I think about constantly. He says, we don't go on the air because we're ready. We go on the air because it's 11:30.
Yes.
And that's kind of that's sort of become my approach to a lot of my own stuff. I recently had to submit a writing sample for a job I was trying to get. And while I did wait until the last possible minute to begin that project, I found that having the ticking clock motivated me in a way that just my own my own ambition and work ethic would not provide.
Yeah, you know, and I can speak for having done a show where we had a sort of a writer's room. You know, we set up the writer's room and we basically had to dole out deadlines. And because we were not paying anybody, it was a free audio podcast, you know, people could break those deadlines. But I noticed that there were some people that just needed that deadline. And I'm one that needs a deadline too. I need to know that I'm going to show this to somebody, and that kind of gets my ass in gear. But I noticed a range of writers doing different things. You know, some would knock it out really quickly, but then they'd need a lot of help with, does this work? I'm not sure it works. And then there's others. And I'm not going to say a name, but it might have been somebody who was on this show once, you know, somebody named Schmalsch Montgomery, who would just be sitting on it, and I'd have to be like, Schmal, there's a deadline coming up, you know, and he's like, I know, I just not, and then finally had to just like, you know, get it off to me, and you know, I'd like to think that helped, that deadline pressure helped, and you know, it was always really good, and you know. I can't fault that process, but that's definitely something where the deadline pressure does do something. You know, it definitely works.
No,
I feel like it's almost
it.
Too easy to get distracted from your projects without that looming deadline, because you can go do some more research. You can go get distracted. You can check Twitter again. You can crawl Tumblr for, you know, inspiring pictures or whatever. And it's not until the clock starts really ticking behind you that I, for a lot of my projects, ever really get going on them. And they're never done when the timer goes off. That they're just, the timer goes off and you have to turn it in, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. So Kelly, actually, since you have a lot of personal projects, do you do a lot where you set your own deadlines and just stick to them?
No, but I never stick to them. That's the problem.
may I direct your attention to a month at the end of the year?
Well, I didn't want to say that
one
specifically.
One has to write a novel in 30 days. But
And one did not.
Oh, no.
This year. No, I mean, if nobody cares, but if it's a personal project, as far as I'm concerned, nobody cares but me. Like, you know, I can have the goal of writing a couple of blog posts a week and, you know, spending 3 hours on a story or whatever. But at the end of the day, nobody cares but me, and nobody's going to give me a paycheck or not give me a paycheck for that. So it's a lot harder with personal stuff. And I even, you know, I try to build in all sorts of reward and recognition and incentive and it doesn't work because I'm a grown-up, but I'll just do what I want anyway. So
that's an interesting question. Where do you get a deadline? I mean, like not being facetious, but like suppose I'm not working. I'm at the point right now where you know, I want to get something written. I want to share it with somebody, but. Because I'm an adult, and because, you know, anybody that I might submit to has plenty of other people they could deal with, they're not going to stand over my shoulder and make me do this. There are exceptions when that has happened to me, and then I did turn something in. But for the most part, so in other words, like in practical terms, if you're sort of at a point where you kind of want to kickstart your writing career. Maybe this is more of a market submission question that we need that is for future things.
Right.
But just sort of what if you're in that situation where you're thinking, I need something to motivate me, I need a deadline, because I'm a grown up, because I'm not taking a class, nobody's going to make me do this. How do you simulate that pressure?
Right. Well, maybe that's where your workshop situation comes in. I mean, I know there are people that have writers groups where the sole purpose is to kind of, you know, shame each other into writing and, you know, make sure you keep doing it. Because that definitely worked for me, you know, having a writer's room and saying like, well, we have to put this podcast out. And once you get that going, that was a serialized podcast. And we missed a lot of our deadlines. But at least I had an audience that was waiting, and that forces you to do it, you know. But you're right. I mean, I think in the end, it comes down to discipline, because – you know, especially if it's something where you're just writing something for yourself. Yeah, you can, you're a grown up, you got other things that are going to come first. You can, I think maybe that's why NaNoWriMo is so popular, because it sort of is a public statement of I'm going to stick to this deadline or try my damnedest. And, you know, this is me making a real go of it. When really, I mean, we all know, if we just had the discipline, we would just do it. You could set your own deadlines and stick to them, but we'll break them because we're human and because writing is something that we can put off. I'm facing the same thing right now, Caroline. I have something that I want to write really bad. I have several things that I want to write, and I'm sticking on it. And I think part of the problem is that I'm not giving myself deadlines to do it. And I don't want to wait for a NaNoWriMo because I think I should just be doing it myself. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's like
so the discipline like of 7 months from now.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, I don't want to wait for that. I want to be able to do it myself. So it's kind of like going to the gym or whatever it is. You know, it's just that matter of discipline, right?
Yeah, and I think in practice, what I end up doing is basically, like you're saying, like peer group imposed deadlines, essentially.
Right.
But that, and you know, I mean, but that has an effect of making me write. It doesn't necessarily have the effect of getting what I'm writing beyond my peer group. So, you know, that's something to think about. Is that, you know, what's the point when you put on the big boy pants or whatever the big girl equivalent is, and say, okay. And, you know, maybe you don't have to. And I'm not saying, you know, not every piece of that you write you necessarily want. But obviously, Dave, like with the Smitty piece, you felt like that was something you were done, you were proud of it, and you thought it could reach a bigger audience.
But I used this show as a discipline to get me through that draft of it, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was...
Well, and that's kind of why we're all here, is that last segment of, you know, what are you working on lately? And too many podcasts go by, and I'm like, I'm not working on anything. And that's definitely that sort of shame motivation.
Is there a writer's equivalent of a personal trainer? The guy you pay to yell at you. Maybe we should offer our services.
Gosh, I would be good at that.
But then they just stop paying you.
Like, no, it's right. I mean, they still need the motivation, right? That's sort of like there's what misery. But
the Kathy Bates motivation.
Right. There's the fan who will kidnap you, cut off your legs, and put you in their house. But I don't think any of us want that.
Right.
Probably.
Right. Well, I mean, what
Make
happens
me
with
offer.
Personal trainers? Do they do personal trainers and gyms just burn through their clients because they just stop going and don't pay?
Yes, but because the thing with a personal trainer, the supply of people who want that who want what you can offer is larger than.
And there's an uptick every January with New Year's resolutions.
Or at least rather who think they want what you can offer. And then
that's part of it, too.
And you say, well, you sign up for a six-month membership, so you don't have to come back for the next 5 months.
Exactly. Right. So that's what we need to do is, you know, people have to sign up for 6 months of writing
of
training.
Motivation training.
Exactly.
Step-free profit.
Well, we've talked about revision, and we've ended up coming up with a great new scam. I mean,
that's right.
Career track for us. So should we start wrapping it up and maybe talk about should we talk about what we're going to do next on this show?
I am so excited about what we're going to do next.
Kelly, take it away.
Well, last year we did, which seems weird to say last year, but last year we did a whole sort of extended series on genre. We, you know, took a show and sort of delved into the nuances of specific genres. This year we are going to look at world building, all the different things that go into world building and how it's done, and we're going to break that apart into a whole bunch of segments, and that's obviously since world building is one of my favorite parts of creating stories. I'm really looking forward to talking about that and listening and learning about that.
Well, this is actually great for me because I think I mentioned this a while ago. I have like an outline for a story where I kind of know what I want the sort of plot and character beats to be, but I don't really know what I feel like it's probably a sci-fi story, but I don't really know the details of how I want that to work. So I think that would be a good exercise for me to try to figure out what I could build into this basic story structure.
So yeah,
it could be magical steampunk.
And I'm excited about this because we did have that tangent in our Reflections and Resolutions show where I started asking you about, you know, the world building stuff, and I got really fascinated because I have been in the last, I'd say, year just kind of re-falling in love with the idea of fantasy. A lot of it had to do with like the fantasy show that we did. It's various things have been pointing me back in that direction because I loved epic fantasy when I was a kid, and then I turned completely away from it, and I'd say over the last year, and now I'm stuffing my face full of it. I sent an email out to you guys asking for book recommendations. I have been playing role-playing
games.
And I
did not shut up for...
and I went with one of your suggestions, and I was reading the Wheel of Time book, the first one of those. And I've been watching Game of Thrones now. So I am like thinking about worlds and building worlds constantly right now, and I'm really looking forward to, you know, what we can talk about in this. And you guys quickly said, well, that's more than just a show. That's a set of shows right there. So we're gonna break that one up and really get in detail into that. So I think that's gonna be cool. So should we talk about what we're working on, Jim? Anything?
Well, in the last 45 minutes, I've become obsessed with the idea of starting a collaboration with Kelly. ever since you started talking about the need for collaborators, I thought, I wonder what a disaster that would be. I've never really been much for collaboration myself, mostly because I don't, you know, I just don't have a pool of resources of people who are talented and interested in doing something like that. But then I thought, who would be the least likely? Like, I can't even imagine what Kelly and I would write about as a unit.
I would love to see this as a deceptionist experiment. This would be fantastic. It makes Kelly so
nervous. I can't really say no to this, can I?
She's trying very hard to be
polite.
Jim,
did you hear the episode?
It's like a public marriage proposal.
I know.
It's like putting it on the scoreboard at Giant Stadium. What are you going to say?
Totally is. Yes, you always say yes in public, and then later let them down easy.
So we will see where we are next time we talk. Right. Yes.
So I'm apparently working on some sort of collaboration with Jim.
It's about vampires who ride dragons.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
We'll workshop it. We'll talk it through.
Cool. Who run a TV network.
Yes.
There you go. Vampires who run a TV network. Done and done.
I kind of like that, actually. I would hear more.
Don't encourage him.
Okay. Well, I guess I am this thing that I have that I've been revising. What is now about 43,000 words should be out of my hands for the time being in a week or so. And then possibly I'm going to start figuring out the short story idea I had and how I can apply that to the world building discussion we're going to have.
Oh, great. Yeah, I think for me, I've been continuing to script the comic book series that I was working on. We finished up issue three. We're on four. I'm not sure anymore, but we've been moving on it, and it's very happy with the way that's coming out. And then, the other stuff is it's too early to talk about. I've been really, and it ties into the world building discussion, but I've just really been kind of wanting to write something, and I don't know if it's fantasy or what it is, but I've been wanting to write something like that, and it's just sort of I'm still in that point where I can't quite get anything on paper yet, and so maybe I need a deadline, and maybe I need, you know, a discussion like this to really get it going, but I also have a little project that I'm working on with Paul Montgomery, and it's a little too early to talk about that one, but we've been sort of having a lot of discussions about something that also involves some world building, and that one could be a comic book project, and again, too early to talk about that, but I kind of like where we're going with that. So.
See, but Paul strikes me as an anti-world builder. That seemed to be one of the major sources of clashing in previous episodes.
Well, we kind of came up with something that we liked that involves a world, but it's sort of one of these transition-y worlds where, you know, it's like somebody in our – it's our world, but it's also another world, and it's one of those type of stories. So, again, I don't want to go too far, but, you know, Paul might get mad at me because we, you know – I don't know how he feels about it yet, but we've been working on something, and that's kind of that's been a fun collaboration too.
What supernatural creatures run the TV network in this world?
Well, not supernatural; they're dinosaurs.
Oh, okay.
You know.
Genetically engineered, right. Just use science vocabulary instead of magic vocabulary, right. And suddenly it's not fantasy anymore.
Mm-hmm. All right, so should we talk about where people can find us online? You can find us on the web at thedeceptionist.org. You can find us on Facebook if you search Deceptionist. Kelly, where can you find us on Twitter?
We are on Twitter at Deceptionists. There is absolutely no the because it's too long. And you can also email us at contact@thedeceptionist.org. And we all have our own Twitter accounts. I'm Anna Luna.
Mad Marvel Girl. Mad Marvel Girl.
Yeah. And I'm D. Acampo, D-A-C-C-A-M-P-O.
And I am Jimsky.
And you should definitely follow us on Twitter because we will put these questions out. So we put a question about revisions out, but the discussion actually just sort of broke out very organically when I mentioned it on Twitter and a bunch of people replied and we started talking about it. And I want to say that we didn't get to everybody's question on here, but I think we probably answered almost everybody's question in some form or another, but really good questions and really fun discussion that just grew out on Twitter. So, I definitely want to do that again for our next show and hopefully we'll get some good feedback, but we really do appreciate it. So I think that about wraps it up then. We told you where you can find us. You can also leave us a review on iTunes. We'd really appreciate that. Not iTunes, but iTunes. That would be the place to go. Not sure what iTunes is about, but
you don't want to know.
You don't even want to know. Don't go there.
It's either illegal for you to be there or you do not want to be there.
All right. Well, I think that does it for us this time. And we'll see you guys next time with our world building show, our first world building show. So I'm Dave.
I'm Jim. Kelly.
We never get this right.
We're collaborating even now.
That's good. I'm Caroline.
Did we get everybody?
I'm not saying my name again.
And that's Kelly over there.
And that's a wrap.
That's a wrap. Bye, everybody.
And what do you need to do to get yourself in a better mood? Well, there's not a lot for you to give if you're giving in. And there's not a lot for you to feel if you're not feeling it. You bring it up and bring it in, and we'll get you fixed up.
So is the after the credit going to be saying something my house is on fire?
Oh, no, we're leaving that in the show.
It would be great if I had never come back.
I will see if I can cut that part out. But really, Jim started talking right after that, so we may actually just leave it in. It doesn't really interrupt it too much. It's kind of funny, so I think we could go with it.
Okay.
We never even got to talk about Kelly's tenure as a beta reader for Buffy the Vampire Slayer / fiction.
I was wondering if you were going to bring
that up, Jim?
I was trying with all my might.
Who hasn't done that?